This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, what would it be like to travel over 6,000 miles for a year on a boat with just one other person? We'll talk to a husband and wife team from Manitowoc who just completed America's Great Loop. Now, the midterm elections ended without widespread claims of fraud and without disruptions at voting locations. In other words, the election was pretty normal. While the midterms came and went without many issues, our next guest says there's still work to be done on state and local election administration, especially before the presidential election in a couple years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you voted in person, did you experience longer lines than anticipated? Was it what you expected? If you voted by mail, did that go smoothly? And if you worked on the election, maybe at a polling station on election day, love to hear your experience, maybe your thoughts on what could work better, even if it's just have more people working at the polling place. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also email ideas@wpr.org. Charles Stewart III is the Kenan Sahin Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's also director of the MIT Election Lab. He co-wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal with Nathaniel Persley called "The Midterms Revealed the Real Challenges Facing Our Elections." Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be here.
In your op-ed, you describe the election as being, as I just said, fairly normal. What do you mean by that?
Well, by normal, we mean that a lot of people showed up to vote. The results were known fairly quickly in most places. There were minimal number of disruptions reported in the news, and almost all of the candidates behaved themselves, including the ones who lost.
Yeah, a lot of what we define as normal, I guess, is based on the things that didn't happen. No widespread claims of fraud. There were fears of disruptions, maybe at polling stations for one reason or another. Were we just too worried, or did we do something right that prevented those things from happening?
It's a bit of both. I mean, I would emphasize the latter, which is that we, and by which I mean election officials mostly at the local level and the workers in the polling places, did what they normally do, which is pay attention to the details and, you know, get this huge logistical operation up and running and successfully completed. I do think in retrospect that many people in the public and some who were kind of prominent figures sometimes went a little too hair on fire worrying about this election. And I think we learned a lot from this midterm election about how to assess the worst case scenarios that may show up on election day.
And before we go into some of those suggestions for the future, there was some reporting that election officials at state and local levels were more proactive than, say, in 2020 at countering misinformation or disinformation about how things were going. Did you see that in action?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of places, especially the most technologically savvy or social media savvy, were very aggressive in getting the message out find the facts, reach out to trusted election officials for information. Many of them were holding what I call petting zoos for election equipment to really show what the equipment is like, and had very well-designed websites with a load of information, press appearance, and those sorts of things. And so I think particularly in larger jurisdictions and jurisdictions that might have a more savvy kind of population, access to more sophisticated media outreach, we saw an awful lot of that, and I'm sure that made a big difference.
Now, that said, did you see hiccups of various sorts that, you know, we might have been able to skate by in a midterm but might be a bigger problem in a higher turnout election like a presidential election year?
Well, I think, you know, the things that we saw were small hiccups, as you call them, but that's normal for a midterm. You know, turnout in a midterm is about 60% of what it is in a presidential election. The big problems that emerge on election day, especially in a presidential year, have to do with capacity and being up against the limits or beyond the limits of the capacity of the system. So, you know, we saw little things this time, which were hiccups, but could be bigger problems in the future. I'll list a couple of them. One was reports of long lines in some places. Another was this problem of recruiting enough election workers in many places that may have led to long lines, but it certainly led to mistakes being made on election day with recording what needs to be recorded. There was also, there were controversies. In fact, Wisconsin was one of the places where there was controversies around, say, drop boxes and the details around how mail ballots would be handled, whether they could be pre-processed, whether they could be processed without a date on them, even if they had been, if they had arrived before election day, things like that, which would be small in number in a midterm because of the nature of the electorate, but in a presidential election where the stakes are much higher, particularly with the presidential office, you can take one state or one locality with a drop box controversy, and you can blow that up into an entire entire battleground state or a couple of battleground states, and that would be maybe a repeat of 2020.
Talking to Charles Stewart, a political scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, director there of the MIT Election Lab, looking at lessons from the midterm election, ways we can improve voting and elections in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest, your experiences as a voter or someone working maybe at a polling station or at a clerk's office. Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Andy is with us in Appleton. Andy, hi.
Hey, Rob and Charles. Pleasantries. I have, I'm a Marine Corps veteran, so I feel like I got a stake in being an American and vote every chance I get. I love the mail-in ballots or drop boxes and get a chance to research the candidates as well as referendums before I cast a vote and feel like it's thoughtful. But my question, my reason for calling in was, I think we had about roughly 2.7 million people voted in this midterms. I know there's a lot of excitement about voting. We had 3.5 roughly million people in Wisconsin who are registered voters. But Wisconsin estimates we have 4.5 roughly million people eligible to vote. So that's a million gap somewhere in there. And how do we encourage people to be registered voters easier?
Andy, thanks a lot for the call. There's a lot there, Charles, when it comes to voter turnout. Are there ways in the election system to make it, less frictiony, make it easier for people who want, as Andy does, to make that move from non-voter to voter?
Absolutely. And we need more people like Andy who vote in a re-election. I mean, I think that's great. This is one of the great conundrums in the United States. I mean, I think that... in Wisconsin, Wisconsin has one of the highest turnout rates in the United States, and Wisconsin actually is almost as frictionless as possible in voting. You have election day registration. You have a tradition of high turnout. There are some small things that could be done in Wisconsin, but the statistics that were cited, I think, suggest just how really hard nationwide it would be to get everybody to vote, short of making voting compulsory. As a kind of one shot item, the one item that I usually emphasize that's not talked about a lot is emphasizing the registration of young people. Again, Wisconsin is already, it's very, very easy in Wisconsin to register and to change your registration. But that's not the case nationwide. And in the United States, our biggest turnout and registration gap is with people who are 30 years of age and younger. The main problem there is that that's a highly mobile population, and they're hard to follow by the campaigns. They just kind of fall off the radar and every time they move. And so if we could do things to instill the habit of voting among young people. That can include pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds, which is allowed in many, many states. Taking the advice of Wisconsin and having election day registration so that people who've been highly mobile can show up and vote, even if they've moved since the last election and can prove that they are who they are. That's something that I would really emphasize, is getting young people on the polls, getting young people signed up. That helps to start the habit, and then it gets them on the list of the candidates, and then the candidates are the ones who actually work hard to get those people who are registered to the polls.
Andy, thanks for that call. Charles, I want to start to get into some of your recommendations for the future now. The heart of this Wall Street Journal piece I mentioned, one, you'd like to see Congress put up some money and resources to help with things like, worker registration and smoothing things out at the polls. What kind of things could the federal government do?
Well, I think, as you mentioned, providing funding could really be the most important thing the federal government can do. I think it's very fraught. If I could step back just for about 10 seconds to note that Congress did have this bill, H.R. 1, that was making its way through Congress. It was a very prescriptive bill. It was very divisive. And I kind of thought from the beginning it would never get through Congress because of the divisiveness. And even if Manchin and Sinema had come along earlier, something else would have happened. And so I think that being very prescriptive at the federal level is something that's not to be advised. But paying for elections could be advised. And I think that there's a good formula that we could use to put federal payments for election administration on a solid footing. And that would be a great thing, an appropriate way, I think, for the federal government to be more involved in helping to support elections.
We're talking to Charles Stewart III, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at MIT, Director there of the MIT Election Lab, talking about the election system in the U.S., how it functioned during the midterms, some changes that could help them go more smoothly in the future. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. As a voter, how did things go for you? Are there things you think could be done to make it better, to make you more confident in your vote? If you work on elections, or maybe you did it for the first time this midterms, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Charles Stewart III, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at MIT, talking about the voting system in the U.S., how it did during the midterm election, possible improvements for the future. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Martha is with us in Menominee. Martha, hi.
Hey, Rob. As usual, I love what you're doing there on this show.
Thanks.
You know, when I was a resident of Virginia, I got my driver's license at 16. I was automatically pre-registered to vote. And then at 18, I got a card in the mail that said, okay, you're a registered voter. Here's your polling location based on your address. You know, polls are open from this time to this time on election day. Next election is whenever, you know. And then it said, if your address changed between, now and when you get this, let us know. But otherwise, that was it. You were in. So, and you had your driver's license. I think they did it because most people, when they're 16, they don't move between 16 and 18, So it was a pretty secure system.
Martha, thanks a lot for sharing that story. That's backing up what you were talking about earlier, Charles, a way to get younger people ready to rock on voting day.
Absolutely.
Martha, thanks a lot for that call. Do we see a trend toward more states doing that? We don't in Wisconsin, for example.
Right. There was a movement for a while for more states doing pre-registration. There's been a bit of a backlash in some Republican-controlled states to undo pre-registration. It's moving very slowly. I think the issue is that many Republicans are noting that young people are overwhelmingly supporting Democratic candidates these days, which makes it a hard sell, particularly in a state that has a so-called Republican trifecta.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Charles, I want to ask about another part of the Wall Street Journal piece. You say, you know, if it's a question of speed or accuracy, when in counting votes, everybody agrees accuracy is more important, but speed matters too. Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're blessed in the United States in that, although we're living through a period of great controversy over our elections. We've not had the degree of controversy that we see in many other countries around the world. And one of the things that election observers have established that really a best practice is to get the election results out to the public as quickly as possible and as transparently as possible. So we've seen in this country that as it takes longer to count votes, it gives an opening to people who would sow discord and misinformation to suggest that something nefarious is going on, that there are people in the back room with printing presses and printing out ballots with their favorite candidate on it. So there is a real value to speeding up the count so long as it is, you know, done quickly. Most of the country actually is able to get, you know, 90-95% of their votes counted, certainly by the Wednesday morning following Election Day. And even many states that don't allow the pre-processing of mail ballots make really good progress on Election Day. States make choices, policy choices, local governments make policy and resource allocation source choices that largely determine how quickly the election returns are reported to the public. And so, I mean, I think we see examples, even in this election, which was pretty normal, of election deniers wanting to focus on the long count in some of the states, especially out west, to suggest that there's something nefarious going on. And there's really only one way to nip that one in the bud, and that's to be serious about the speed of counting and not just to dismiss the issue by just saying, well, we're going to be accurate at the expense of being fast. You can have both to a certain degree.
Let's go back to our callers. Randy is with us in La Crosse. Randy, hello.
Well, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm 70, so I've been voting for a long time, and almost every election I voted for the lesser of two evils. So if we could solve that dilemma, we might encourage more people to want to come out and vote. Also, if we had direct referendum, I think every election there should be two or three direct referendums on the ballot so that the people could actually start to be governed by their own desires.
Randy, thanks for the call. Charles, of course, we in Wisconsin can read headlines about other states and their ballot referenda, their binding ones. Here in Wisconsin, we have non-binding advisory ones at the county or local level. Constitutional amendments have to get passed twice by the legislature, and then they go to voters. But that's it. We don't have that. Do you have thoughts on pros or cons of states moving toward binding statewide referenda that at least Randy would like to see more of?
Right. Well, you know, that's very interesting. I have to say it is a bit of a surprise given the progressive history of Wisconsin that y'all don't have what's known as the initiative, citizen initiative for legislating. Well, you know, in terms of turnout, there does appear to be a pull to having initiatives on the ballot. I've recently quipped that if you want a high turnout election, make sure you put a recreational marijuana question on the ballot, because you'll get another 5% of the vote to turn out just because of a pot referendum. And you also, you know, oftentimes states will put these initiatives on low turnout elections, like the spring primaries, during the midterm elections, and they do actually get more people to the polls, and it does make those elections more representative of what the electorate is than in those otherwise small or low turnout elections.
Thanks for calling in, Randy. Charles, we got through this midterm election, as you said earlier, with a pretty normal election. Do you have hopes that some of the changes you're looking for would find support in Congress, bipartisan support in Congress, or at the state level to get some of these changes and better support for polling stations and such in place for the 2024 presidential elections?
Yes, a couple of things really quickly. First of all, they're in the current appropriations bill moving through Congress in the lame duck. I understand that there's several hundred million dollars allocated to election administration. Probably for security, I could be wrong about that, but there is seriousness in Congress about the federal government paying its fair share, and that's a good down payment. So I'm hoping that that stays in the bill. That would be wonderful for Congress to do. At the state level, I think in general, one of the things I've noticed in the past year as I've gone around the country talking to state legislatures and election officials all over the place, including in many of these states, red and purple states, where there's really been a lot of tension, that there is a hunger, actually, when you talk to legislators privately about election administration, there is a hunger to get back to more evidence-based legislating in the election administration realm. And so I am hoping, now that the temperature has been turned down a little bit, that when the state legislatures convene in January, there will be greater interest in, you know, dealing with issues of the speed of counting, mail ballots, recruiting election officials or election workers, threats against election workers, and those sorts of things. I think there is an opening that we have over the next several months to take advantage of this kind of era of good feeling in election administration.
Charles, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Charles Stewart III, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Director of the MIT Election Lab. He joined us to talk about a piece he co-wrote for the Wall Street Journal. It's called "The Midterms Revealed the Real Challenges Facing Our Elections." Still time for you to share your thoughts. If there's an election change you'd like to see here in Wisconsin, email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow morning, Thanksgiving Day at 11, get last-minute cooking help for your Thanksgiving meal. It's this year's edition of Turkey Confidential. I'm keeping it pretty simple, going to grill, not turkey, chicken on the grill. That's my plan, so I don't think I'm going to need any of their help. Maybe you do. That's tomorrow morning at 11 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday, I shared the 10 most common dog names for 2022, but maybe you're thinking, Rob, I have to name a dog and I want something different from everybody else. I got you, fam, because last night I stumbled across a great new source of dog names. From the website Metafilter, I saw an article about dogs in medieval Europe. It included a list created by Edward, 2nd Duke of York, in the early part of the 1400s. The list is titled "The Names of All Manner of Hounds." There are over 1,000 names on the list. Duke Edward liked his dogs, and he had some time on his hands. Here are some samples. You have to picture the old-fashioned spellings. Honeyball, Conqueror, Helpless or Harmless, Brian with a Y, Filth or Filthy, I'm not sure what to do with that E on the end, Bracelet, Rude Enough, Rage, Pretty Man and Pretty Boy, Mr. Man, Nosewise, Tully Mully, Brainless, and best of all, the name Best of All. Medieval dog news you can use. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about NASA's Artemis 1 mission to the moon. Now, have you ever wanted to drop everything, hop in a car, a plane, a boat, and just go? That's, in effect, what our next guest did with a little more planning in a single-engine trawler boat. Their journey took over a year and was more than 6,000 miles long. It's called America's Great Loop, a giant loop including rivers, waterways, and some open ocean that takes you around the eastern chunk of the United States. Jill and James Iverson started that journey where they live in Manitowoc and ended the trip there in September. Jill, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob.
And James, thanks for being with us.
Hi, it's my pleasure.
James, can you briefly tell us what America's Great Loop is?
Well, you kind of described it well in your introduction. It's a circumnavigation of the eastern third of the United States and part of Canada, and it's about 6,000 miles long. It includes going through about 106 locks, and there's voyages on the Great Lakes, on the rivers, on the Gulf of Mexico, and the Atlantic Ocean.
Wow. And Jill, I imagine you don't just hop in your boat and do this. What kind of planning and preparation went into this trip?
Well, we did do some planning. We're longtime cruisers, I should tell you that. So maybe we didn't have to do quite as much planning as people that are brand new to boating. And there are people that do the loop with very little experience, but we've been boating for decades. So, but to get ready for this trip, we did some planning, but not too much, because we really like to be spontaneous and make plans along the way as we go.
I want to ask each of you a favorite part of the trip, and I know it'll be hard to pick just one, but what's something that stood out in your mind? Jill, let's start with you.
Okay. Although I loved big, you know, New York City and being alongside the Statue of Liberty, I have to say St. John's River was really, really special. It's old Florida, old world Florida. So we took a 150-mile side trip off the loop from Jacksonville, Florida, and went all the way down the state, down the middle of the state. And we were especially excited to anchor out behind Pontoon State Park on the Dead River. It was like a jungle. We were surrounded at night using our beam. We saw alligator eyes, and we heard limpkins, which are birds that scream and sound like someone being murdered. People actually call 911 when they hear these birds. And wood storks, who are huge storks that can clack through bones. So we felt like we were in Jurassic Park. It was wonderful. We stayed an extra 2 days.
Wow. And James, did you have another favorite part?
Yeah, I have to say, as much as I love the St. John's River, one of the highlights for me was anchoring out right next to the Statue of Liberty and spending the night there and watching the lights of the city wink on at night and just being surrounded by it all. And the statue itself is such an iconic thing. We've all seen photographs of it, but to be anchored right next to it was quite a thrill for me.
And Jill, I might think, you know, you're in a boat, just the two of you. It might be kind of like isolating, but reading up on what you did, it sounds like there's a really strong feeling of community, and you met a lot of interesting people along the way.
Oh, we really did. First of all, especially on the rivers, you really build relationship with the other loopers because you all have to go through the locks. And by the way, we went through 106 locks on these trips. So you all have to go through the locks, and you all have to tie up to a wall or a marina or anchor. So we kept running into the same people and building relationships. We also built relationships with a lot of local people. We went out of our way to meet local people everywhere we went. And we also stayed in touch with our dear friends via social media. I don't know what I would do without Instagram and Facebook. We really, since we didn't go home for a whole year, it was really important that people kept in touch with us and we kept in touch with people. And we felt like we had our little 33-foot boat was filled with a couple of hundred good friends.
And James, you both mentioned the locks. I like locks. I like just watching, you know, standing on the shore and watching boats go through them. 106, though, did you ever get tired of locks, or were they still cool after, you know, number 105?
Well, they're physically kind of demanding. And sometimes you have to wait because pleasure boats are the lowest priority in locks. Commercial traffic has purse dibs on a transit through the locks. And so, you know, sometimes, especially on the rivers, on the Mississippi River, I had to wait several hours at a lock in order to get through. And, you know, the surface of Lake Michigan is about 579 feet above sea level. So in order to get from here to the Atlantic Ocean, you have to go down 579 feet, which means a lot of locks. And then to get back, you have to go up 579 feet. So you're transiting all sorts of locks. But I'll tell you what, the people that operate the locks are public servants in the best sense. They were all very nice and very professional, and we always had wonderful experiences with them.
And Jill, I got to ask as we wrap up, you were gone for well over a year. You said you were in social media contact with people. What was homecoming like, though, getting back home and seeing everybody and starting to settle back in?
Well, I would say, like in The Wizard of Oz, like Dorothy said, there's no place like home. It was just wonderful to get back home and see all our friends and family and to reintegrate ourselves into our community once again.
And Jill, your thoughts on homecoming?
Well, you know, we didn't get to see our grown sons for a whole year and their ladies. And they came down and caught the lines for us. We also had James and I put some bucks on the bar at the Stage Door Pub, the Irish pub in our town, and everyone came out and had a beer with us. And, you know, it was very, very touching. I have to say, in a lot of ways, you know, we came back different people from this trip, and I'd say even better people. You know, just really appreciating all the people in our lives and appreciating our country. It looks a lot better from the water when you don't see strip malls and you don't have to ride on a bunch of ugly highways. You know, it's a pretty wonderful country, and Canada we love so much. Our Canadian friends are so important to us. So, you know, it's great to be home. Not to say we won't have another adventure, because we've got some planned.
Thank you both so much for joining us, and congratulations on completing the trip. We've been talking to Jill and James Iverson. They live in Manitowoc. They recently completed a year-plus journey around the eastern part of the U.S. on their boat. It's called The Great Loop. They're in the process of writing a book about the experience. And you can find more info on their Instagram page. We've got a link at wpr.org/centraltime. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a local author's obsession with his favorite snack.
All right, I like to snack just as much as the next person. My go-to, chips and salsa. And I have a serious weak spot for meat snacks, jerky, summer sausage. But I met this guy, Jesse, who's taken things to the next level.
My name is Jesse Brookstein, all-around meat geek and author of A Perfect Pair, The History of Landeger in Greene County, Wisconsin.
Did you catch that? He wrote a book about one particular type of snack sausage. I thought it was pronounced Landjager.
But the proper pronunciation is Landjager.
Landjager. Got it. Jesse and I met up at Bavaria Sausage in Madison, Wisconsin, so I could learn a little more. He introduced me to the owner.
My name is Judy Cottrell. I'm the owner of Bavaria Sausage.
Judy's a lifer at Bavaria.
I've been here my whole life because my parents started this business. So I've been peeling wieners since I was 5.
Bavaria's been making sausage in Madison since the early 60s.
So my dad is a master sausage maker, master spice mixer from Bavaria. So these are all authentic Bavarian recipes.
Including the recipe for Landjager, which I asked her to share with our radio audience.
Share the recipe,
yeah,
the ingredients?
Then you just go ahead and I'll record it.
Yeah. All I'll say is they're all beef, no fillers, no additives, no MSG. Natural hickory smoke.
So that's all we get?
That's all you get.
So what sets Landjager apart?
Landjager is a shelf-stable product. So it goes through a fermentation process in here that drops the pH to such a level that there's no longer any spoilage or pathogenic bacteria in this product.
All right, no refrigeration necessary. They're also kind of flattened, like a long rectangle.
That's done with these molds or these presses that the Landjager producers have. And not only are they in that rectangular shape, but they also come as a pair. And that's part of the reason I think Landjager stands out as opposed to so many other sausages in the world, is that unique form and shape.
So let's investigate. First, where'd it come from? I'm guessing Germany?
But it seems like it somewhat spread from what we now know as westernmost point of Austria into Germany, into Switzerland, and into a Swiss, German, French region of France called Alsace.
Okay, and so what about the name?
The direct translation is Landjager is land hunter or country hunter.
Jesse found they were popular among hunters and game wardens hiking around the forests of the region. And later, folks from that region emigrated to the United States and settled in spots like southern Wisconsin and upstate New York, where Jesse grew up. When he moved to Wisconsin, he spotted Landjager all over the place, hanging in their classic chalet-style display cases.
And the geek that I am, I took that childhood relationship I had with it to this adulthood infatuation, I guess you could say it's become, and started researching it, and the book was born.
You found a bunch of makers in Greene County, where Swiss immigrants settled in places like New Glarus. And it also led him to Judy at Bavaria Sausage.
I mean, I think we've been making them over 60 years. These have won gold medal in international competition. So, you know they're good, we know they sell, we make a lot of them.
Judy says it's a labor of love and a dying art.
You know, there's probably a handful of places left like us in the whole United States that really have the family recipes.
But Judy says that tradition extends to her generations of loyal customers, too.
You know, it's something that gets passed on to generation.
So, speaking of passing things on...
One more chance. You want to share the recipe for our listeners?
That would kill my livelihood right there.
Had to try.
So that's pretty much what we do.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. And thanks, Jesse.
Thank you, man. Really appreciate it.
For more on Landjäger and Jesse's book, you can visit his website, KarateFightPublishing.com. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, we'll learn about NASA's Artemis 1 launch. It launched last week. It's the first step to getting humans back on the moon after a 50-year hiatus. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. NASA's Space Launch System rocket went into space last week, starting the Artemis 1 mission. Artemis 1 is the first step in a three-part mission to get humans back on the moon after a 50-year absence. Jack Burns is a professor in the Department of Astrophysical and Planetary Sciences and professor in the Department of Physics at the University of Colorado, Boulder. Jack, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
So as I mentioned, Artemis 1 launched last week. What have we seen so far?
Well, it's going very well. In fact, it's nearly flawless, is what I understand from NASA at this point. It was we had a number of delays going all the way back to August and September. But when it finally launched, it's been functioning extremely well, and now it's in the orbit of the moon.
This is part of a bigger mission, the last stage of which is to get humans back on to the moon. Can you talk about that long-term goal of not just probes, uncrewed probes, but bringing humans back onto the moon's surface?
Yes. This first mission is just to test out the system. Then Artemis 2, which is going to launch in about 2 years, we'll have the first crew. They too will orbit the moon. And then finally, Artemis 3 in 2025, 2026 will land. That will be the first humans on the moon in the 21st century. And as NASA likes to advertise, it'll be the first woman and the first person of color to be able to go to the moon. So, Artemis is very different than Apollo in that it is intended not to be a short-term program, not to fulfill political goals, but to be a long-term, sustainable set of missions that will result in a long-term presence on the surface for science, for extraction of resources, to manufacture materials using lunar metals and oxygen, and even water from the surface of the moon.
It's a long road to get to that point. With Artemis 1, what are some of the key things that we need to find out to make sure that Artemis 2, with actual humans on board, are ready to go up?
Yeah, it's mainly to test out the engineering systems. So obviously the first step was the launch, make sure that this new rocket, the Space Launch System, was working. That's a box we can tick off now. Next is to understand the radiation environment in the moon. The Orion spacecraft, which will house the astronauts as part of the launch system, is in orbit of the moon, and it's going to be there for about 25 days. And we'll test out all of the communications, the the computer systems and see how everything does in terms of the radiation environment. Because once we're away from the Earth's magnetic field, we no longer have that protection. So that's one thing that they're looking at doing to test out all those systems. Then very importantly is coming back from the moon. The Orion spacecraft is going to be traveling at over 25,000 miles per hour. And so when it hits the atmosphere, the big item to be tested is the heat shield, because that heat shield is absolutely essential to protect the astronauts. Now, we have high confidence that's going to work because we certainly have well over 50 years of experience with such heat shields. And this is a modern version of what was used by Apollo.
Now, the Apollo missions successfully delivered people to the moon a couple few times. We got to do a little science, humankind. The astronauts got to do a little science on the lunar surface, but their time was limited. Their gear was limited. What kind of hopes do you have for science we can do on the lunar surface if we can return there?
Well, this time Artemis really is largely about science. It's not driven as was Apollo with the political goals. So the science is very broad based. One of the things we are excited to do is to go to the lunar far side and to something called the South Pole Aiken Basin, which is the oldest, largest impact basin in the inner solar system, bring some samples back, because that's going to tell us information about the formation of not just the moon, but the Earth-Moon system and the time period in which life was first formed. So learning about ourselves and our history is one of the important goals of Artemis. Another goal, something that I'm working on as an astronomer, is we're going to be setting up radio telescopes on the surface of the moon. Our first mission actually is going to be in March. We have a unmanned lunar lander we'll be setting down in the South Pole, and that will be followed in subsequent years by putting down an array of radio telescopes on the radio quiet far side, which is always facing away from the Earth.
Okay, I was going to ask my next question is, what are the benefits of parking a radio telescope on the moon in particular? I guess we have a lot of radio waves here on the Earth, or otherwise I wouldn't have a job, for starters.
Well, that's exactly right. All of the, there's a great deal of radio interference. That's number one. But also number two is our own ionosphere. Our ionosphere bounces the lower frequency radio waves back into space, so they don't even penetrate all the way to the surface. This is frequencies below about 10 or 15 or 20 megahertz, so below the FM band. But that is a key part of the spectrum for us to open up on the moon, because that allows us to probe an unexplored part of the universe called the Dark Ages. This is before the first stars and galaxies formed.
Wow. When could we start, assuming all goes well with landing this and installing it and firing it up, when can we start to see results from that radio telescope on the far side of the moon?
Well, our first mission to the far side is already scheduled and fully funded. It's a mission called Lucy that will be a single radio telescope, a pair of antennas, and we'll be operating through the night. And this will be our first attempt to do what we call cosmology from the moon. That is to explore that early epoch. That's going to happen in 2025.
Now, you mentioned part of the goal of having crews land on the moon is to have some kind of sustainable presence there and being able to manufacture some of the things humans would need on the moon using local materials. In our last minute or so, are there enough of those materials to use on the moon?
Oh, yes. The moon has all the same elements as does the Earth. And we've learned in the last decade, it also has water ice at the poles. That water ice is, in principle, like gold, or maybe even a better analog, petroleum is on the Earth, because we can take the water, split it into hydrogen and oxygen, recombine it into rocket fuel, which we don't have to then bring all of that rocket fuel from the Earth. It's a lot easier to lift it off the moon. So the Moon could become a fuel depot for launches, not only from the moon, but launches that then go further out into space, including trips to Mars.
Jack, thanks again for joining us today.
You're certainly welcome.
That's Jack Burns, professor in the Department of Astrophysical and Planetary Sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder. He talked to us about NASA's Artemis 1 mission. It launched last week, the first, as we heard, in what's expected to be a long line of moon-related missions. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll delve into the history behind a Wisconsin legend, the creation of Dungeons & Dragons, and the rise and fall of the company behind it, all centered around their roots in Lake Geneva. And when you try learning a new skill or hobby, chances are you're not going to be that good at it, and that's okay. We'll find out what we can learn from being bad at things and why those things are still worth doing. If you've got one of those you're trying right now, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's tomorrow here on Central Time.